Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Mario Ritter Jr., Susan Shand, and Alice Bryant. Later, we will present the next part in our series on America's national parks. But first, here is Mario Ritter Jr.
Pro-democracy protesters in Hong Kong moved into the city's public transportation system Tuesday morning. Subway passengers argued with hundreds of activists who blocked train doors. Subway service was delayed and partially suspended at some stations. Reporters observed clashes between demonstrators and angry passengers who could not get out of subway cars. Hong Kong's mass transit railway sent minibuses to replace trains affected by the demonstration. It also urged people to seek other methods of transportation. The aims of protesters have expanded since the Hong Kong government announced plans to amend the city's extradition laws. Officials proposed the amendments in February. Under the extradition bill, the government would send Hong Kong residents who are charged with crimes to mainland China for trial. Critics say the bill could threaten Hong Kong's self-rule and its legal system. In March, thousands of people protested in the former British colony against the proposal. The protests have continued for months, with demonstrators blocking traffic and clashing with police, sometimes violently. The chief executive of Hong Kong, Carrie Lam, has faced strong criticism for seeming to carry out the will of mainland China over that of the people of Hong Kong. Lam at first refused to set the extradition bill aside. But by June, she was forced to suspend the bill in an effort to satisfy protesters. Then, on July 1st, a large group of protesters forced their way into Hong Kong's main legislative building. They broke glass doors, tore down pictures, painted on the walls, and raised a former colonial flag. The action took place on the 22nd anniversary of Hong Kong's return to China. Since then, tensions have increased between the demonstrators and supporters of Lam and mainland China. Earlier in July, a group of men in white shirts attacked and beat many people at the Yuen Long train station. The men wore white, apparently as a sign of opposition to protest leaders who wear black. Those who were attacked included people wearing black shirts. Soon after the attack, police said they arrested six men. They accused some of having links to criminal gangs. The area around the station is said to be controlled by groups known as triads. The attack shocked many in Hong Kong and led to accusations that the police were cooperating with gang members to target protesters. It also took place as demonstrations appeared to be calming down. Since the bill was suspended, protesters have expanded their demands to include greater democratic reforms. The protesters also fear police are targeting them with force. Ken Chan took part in the subway demonstration Tuesday. He wanted transportation officials to explain why they reportedly failed to take action during the attack by white-shirted men. How could they let the triads in white attack people on the platform randomly, including the elderly and children in the train, he said. Lorraine Lee said the latest protest shows that the government has failed to deal with social, economic, and political problems. That is why now Hong Kongers have no choice but to use different creative approaches to remind people what is happening in Hong Kong, she said. The transportation blockage was only the latest in a series of protests in different parts of the city. On Sunday, police fired tear gas and rubber bullets at protesters who were blocking streets. Protesters carried umbrellas, a sign of the protest movement. Officials in Beijing have restated their support for Lam, but also expect her to deal with the unrest. Chinese Foreign Ministry official Hua Chunying on Tuesday blamed foreigners for supporting the protests. She said the central government opposes any foreign forces' attempts to intervene in Hong Kong affairs. I'm Mario Ritter, Jr.
Indonesia's president said that he wants to build a large seawall around Jakarta. The goal is to prevent the low-lying capital from being flooded by the sea. But President Joko Widodo and his government may not have a lot of time. Some experts forecast that, at the current rate, one-third of Jakarta might be underwater by 2050. The crisis facing the city is the result of many years of uncontrolled development. There has been little city planning. Many politicians have served business interests and not the public's interest. Many of the city's millions of people take groundwater from wells because the water pipe system does not serve all areas. This has caused the city to slowly sink as the groundwater beneath it disappears. The ground has been sinking at an average rate of about 10 centimeters a year in some areas. Rising sea levels linked to climate change could make the problem worse in the future. Widodo told the Associated Press recently that it is time to move ahead with the seawall project. The government began thinking about a wall about 10 years ago. This huge project will need to be done quickly to prevent Jakarta from sinking under the sea, he said. Widodo, known as Jokowi in Indonesia, also discussed other plans for the development of Jakarta. The city and surrounding area is home to 30 million people, but it has problems with pollution and congestion. Jokowi also restated that he wants to build a new capital city. He suggested that it would not be on the main island of Java, where 57% of the country's nearly 270 million people live. We want to separate the capital, the center of government, and Jakarta as a business and economic center, he said. We don't want all the money existing only in Java. We want it to be outside Java as well. Jakarta's flooding and earthquakes are also a problem. Widodo said, we need to make sure our capital is safe from disasters. He did not name the place where the new capital would be built. Jakarta has been called one of the world's fastest sinking cities. It is close to the sea, and 13 badly polluted rivers run through it. Too much groundwater has been removed, while heavy buildings have been built in many places. Hari Andreas is a scientist at Indonesia's Bandung Institute of Technology. He said that in some parts of northern Jakarta, the ground is already 2 to 4 meters below sea level. He added that it is sinking by as much as 20 centimeters a year. At this rate, said Andreas, 95% of northern Jakarta will be underwater by 2050. He said water would cover about one-third of the city. Andreas said it took time for his predictions to be taken seriously by Indonesian government officials. He is pleased the large seawall is being planned. The $42 billion project will have 3 stages. It will start with strengthening 30 kilometers of existing coastal dams. After that, 17 new islands will be built. This would be followed by building the large seawalls along the western and eastern part of the city's coastline. However, many politicians argue about the cost. There is also fear the wall will hurt the fishing industry. Andreas recently met with government officials. He said he believes a smaller seawall project would be less costly. In this smaller plan, a 20-kilometer-long wall would be built to protect areas most at risk. It would give the government more time to plan for the future. Fishermen are worried. Muara Angke is a small fishing port in northern Jakarta. Here, 63-year-old Pandi said the scientists are wrong. He says flooding is part of life on the waterfront. If we can't work, we will suffer for a long time, he said. Sinking below water, he said, is just part of the risk. I'm Susan Shand.
In the United States, multiplayer video games are becoming big business. The industry is expected to earn over $1 billion in profits this year. More and more colleges and universities are creating esports programs. Some colleges are even offering top players scholarship money. But most of those scholarships have been going to male players. The situation risks following a path similar to American football. High schools and colleges spend and earn a lot of money on the sport. American football players are almost entirely boys and men. So males receive almost all of the resources. But nearly half the people who play video games in the U.S. are girls. So esports have a chance to be different. To try to change things, a former U.S. Department of Education official has helped an all-girls school launch a varsity esports program. The official, Jay Collins, says the program shows how high schools can appeal to a greater range of gamers. The goal is for different kinds of people to earn esports scholarships and other opportunities. Since leaving the education department, Collins has been teaching at Hathaway Brown, an all-girls school near Cleveland, Ohio. Collins compares the path for girls in esports to the one facing girls and gender minorities in science, technology, engineering, and math, the subject grouping called STEM.
Research shows many girls begin to avoid STEM-related subjects around middle school. Possible reasons include lack of role models, toxic culture, and generally feeling like they don't fit in that world, Collins said. Collins helped organize a league for esports teams from 10 schools and libraries in the Cleveland area. The players are a mix of students from urban and rural areas, wealthier and poorer families. At least one of the schools is only for girls. As a result, all of the players on the esports team are female. In order to appeal to a wide range of students, the league chose three games for the competitions. One was a sports game called Rocket League. Another was a digital card game called Hearthstone. And a third was an online battle game called Heroes of the Storm. Collins says game choice is important if schools want to reach more than just male students. For example, Collins did not include League of Legends, which is one of the world's most popular esports games. But none of its top players are women, and its culture has been described as toxic. Players in Collins' league have reported liking the games that were chosen. Ninth grade student Claire Hofstra was among the most passionate players. Collins asked her to find four other girls to complete the school's Heroes of the Storm team. Heroes of the Storm has a few similarities to League of Legends, a game that girls supposedly do not like. Yet the team's members enjoyed it so much, they continued to play together, even when the season ended. Some girls say playing esports has helped them in other ways. Juliana Renix was in her first year at Hathaway Brown and lives about an hour away from the school. She says the esports team helped her make friends.
Kayla Morris, another freshman, once described herself as shy. Over time, she learned to speak up and trust in her abilities. She recently served as a broadcaster during the league's championship games. And Claire Hofstra overcame the social pressure she felt at her former school to give up gaming. Having an esports team at Hathaway Brown influenced her decision to keep playing. She said, "I definitely felt the pressure, just because I'm a girl. People don't really take you seriously." All three students who spoke to the Associated Press plan to return to the esports team next season. They also said they would think about playing esports at the college level, especially if they earn a scholarship. It is a small but hopeful step for Jay Collins, who is transgender. Collins has at times felt more connected and more distant from other people because of video games. Maybe the most hopeful result from the first year esports league was that the girls had only one criticism. They said they did not get enough time interacting with students from other schools. Games can bring people together. They can just sit down and start playing together. That's a beautiful thing, Collins said. I'm Alice Bryant.
On our national parks journey, we explore a unique place where two deserts meet. The hot, harsh, rocky landscape is home to a rare and strange-looking tree. In fact, the park gets its name from this iconic plant. Welcome to Joshua Tree National Park in southeastern California. The limbs of Joshua trees stretch and twist upward in all directions. At the end of each limb are sharply pointed green leaves. The plant looks like a large cactus and can grow over 12 meters tall. But as the National Park Service explains, Joshua trees are not really even trees. They are succulents that belong to the yucca family. Succulents are desert plants that can hold a lot of water inside them. Joshua trees are not exactly beautiful. An early explorer to the area once described them as the most repulsive tree in the vegetable kingdom. But park visitors are amazed by the wild-looking forests of Joshua trees.
The Mormon religious group is said to have given the plant its name. Mormon settlers reportedly thought it looked like the Christian holy figure Joshua, his arms held out, guiding travelers to the Promised Land. Joshua trees thrive in the climate of the Mojave, one of two deserts within the park. The Mojave is a high desert. It is 900 meters above sea level. It is also relatively cool and wet. The Mojave Desert meets up here with the Colorado Desert. The Colorado is a lower desert. It makes up the eastern part of the national park. Much of the park sits within the overlap of the two deserts. The overlap creates a diverse ecosystem where many plants and animals thrive.
Within the park, you can find bighorn sheep, desert tortoises, iguanas, and black-tailed jackrabbits. The park is also home to 250 kinds of birds, like the red-tailed hawk, the roadrunner, and the Scots Oriole. After spring rainstorms, desert wildflowers burst to life in colorful display. The blooms on Joshua trees are bright white. Cacti produce bright purple, red, and orange wildflowers. The blooms last just a few weeks before the hot summer heat becomes too strong. Along with Joshua trees, large piles of rocks are another defining part of the park's landscape. The huge boulders sit stacked on top of each other. Roads and hiking trails lead visitors through paths of these boulders.
Joshua Tree National Park is over 320,000 hectares. It has many hiking and walking trails, from long hikes that take all day to finish to short ones, like the Hidden Valley Trail. This trail takes you through an area that was once a place for cattle-stealing cowboys to hide out. The area's massive rock piles made for effective places to hide in the desert. These huge boulder piles and rock walls have made Joshua Tree National Park world famous for rock climbing and bouldering. The park has more than 8,000 climbing routes. John Hockhausler often comes to Joshua Tree to rock climb and enjoy nature. He makes the 3-hour drive from Los Angeles, where he is a lawyer.
When you see the park from down low, it's beautiful, but when you see the park from 150, 200 feet up, it's amazing.
Renat Ehrlich visited the national park with Hockhausler. She is also a lawyer in Los Angeles. She had just tried rock climbing at Joshua Tree for the first time.
We love it. We come here to walk on trails. Last time we were here, we rode jeeps, which was so much fun. And it's just a great place. Great outdoorsy place. It's a lot of character.
I'm Katie Weaver.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.